This is Art Moves. Art Moves is a series of curated conversations at the intersection of art, innovation, and social justice.
Each week, we'll be talking with the innovative thinkers and doers who are forging new ground in the creative arts or redefining what it means to be creative.
I'm Tony Williams.
And I'm Ela Kislansky.
And we're your hosts for Art Moves. I've known this gentleman for some time, and I think the world of him because he's so warm and brilliant. But anyway, let me just say a few words about Dr. Darrell Cooper. He is the founder of Cultural Innovations Group, and he also has his own podcast called Fluency, and he's going to be co-hosting with us this season for various guests on Art Moves. So welcome, Dr. Darrell Cooper.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much, Tony. Thank you, Eli. I feel so welcomed being here. Thank you.
Now, is it okay if I call you Darrell or should I call you Dr. Darrell? Which one do you want?
You can call me whatever you like, Tony.
We'll call him Doc.
I love that. I want to start off with the fact, you know, just learning more about what art moves you. What do you have an art practice? What moves you about art? What sings to you? What talks to you?
Ooh, so my background is that of a theater practitioner. So I was an actor in high school and in college. And what moved me about theater was really finding universality in the human nature.
Ooh.
You know, what is it about that that connects us all together? That's what originally allowed me to fall in love with art in that way. But actually, to go back even, a little bit farther than that, before I even knew it, when I was in middle school, I was actually performing in this hip hop group. We were called the 334 Boys. We would travel around Montgomery, Alabama, where I'm from. And sometimes a little bit outside of Montgomery as well. We would perform at like talent shows and different like, you know, events. And we would get paid to perform. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, like thinking back on that, being like 12 and 13, I didn't really, you know, look at it as like being paid to perform. I was just kind of hanging out with my friends and, you know,
having a good time,
bonding, you know, yeah. We all kind of love the music and the culture. But, you know, I was in love with it and employed by it, you know, before I knew it. So much so that it was very much so, second nature. So, you know, I fell in love before, you know, with art very early on. And, you know, it's one of those things. I don't think, you know, we get to choose art. I think art chooses us, much like with our careers, you know, I think our careers choose us as well. And so, you know, I was just very thankful that, art chose me to be able to have certain gifts to be able to share it and be able to experience it.
Well, you know, Darrell, we have something in common because when I moved to New York City, I came here to be an actress, you know, and you know, what I found was it was almost like therapy because as you assume other characters, you may have blocks, but the blocks were within you, so to speak. So I understand the whole acting piece and, you know, but I used to get stage fright. But then I'd have to talk. But this is how I talked myself out of it. I said, no one is coming here to see you fail. Mm. They want to be entertained. So make friends with the audience. And that's the mentality that I would take. But we're not here to talk about me. We're here to talk about you. There's something else that's really interesting about your background. You're also ordained. Talk to us about that spiritual walk that you're on as well.
Yeah. So this is actually something that's new in the sense of like being ordained is very new. My best friend in high school, she's getting married this summer. And, she asked if I would officiate her wedding. And so, you know, because my immense love for her and, her partner, I said yes. And that required the ordination process to happen.
And I thought I saw light around you. You mean that's not a halo?
You know, it may be, you know, But I will say this, my mother was very excited when she found that out because, you know, she had been saying that for years that that's something that she saw for me. So yeah, that portion of it is pretty new. But as far as like the spiritual walk, I mean, whew, from birth, you know, I feel like, you know, the creator knew who we were before we were even here. So
I agree
just,
with you on that.
Yeah,
oh, I so agree. We're going to have that conversation off podcast.
Oh, let's go.
I want to. Anyway, so Eli, we got to let you in here.
I see a bunch of things. One, I was thinking about this idea about stage fright. Mm-hmm. And I read this little quote sometimes you have in magazines, Waiting for the Dentist. And it's this actor who's about to go on stage and he's terrified. He wants to vomit. He's saying to himself, why am I doing this? And like, you know, it's Laurence Olivier.
Yeah, I remember.
Age 70.
Yeah, had it, you know.
Yeah.
Which it's is a, like it's a
never,
real thing.
This never goes. But, you know, I was intrigued by this definition of yourself, if you will, or just a way, the perspective of a cultural strategist. You know, let's talk a little bit about that. And I guess as part of that, you bring people together. And you also it requires a gift of connecting people and building bridges to make art more accessible and just help people realize their vision, et cetera. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for that, Eli. I'm a very big proponent of entrepreneurship and social entrepreneurship. And when I realized that, you know, at the time I was working at the New York City Department of Cultural Affairs, and I knew I wanted to go out on my own. And so I had been planning like to start my own business and my own company, but I didn't really know what I was doing, what it was called. That it was even a real thing.
Right.
You know, like I knew there was some other people that were doing it, but what is it really? Especially because you are sort of, you know, figuring it out, a lot of it as you go. And then I realized one of the strongest things that we have as people, especially people of color, is our cultural capital. And then how do we use that? Right? How do we take the cultural capital and turn it into something that can generate a life, generate a career, a way to build a path forward for yourself and for other people? And in just sort of doing this work and thinking about what that was, the term cultural strategist sort of started to emerge as what it was that I was doing. You know, it really was using our innate abilities to be ourselves as a way to be able to change the narratives of what was happening within our society. And then the building bridges piece was, you know, really a key part to that because, you know, the distance from, you know, one person to another, in my opinion, is really the amount of empathy and kindness you can extend to that individual. Because we're really not all that different.
I want to just highlight what you just said. You said empathy and kindness. So very important. Continue, please. I just wanted to bring to surface that comment.
It's a big missing in society.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yes, it's something missing in society. And especially when we start talking about business and, you know, entrepreneurship, the way in which, you know, we sort of operate in that space. You can never over index on kindness. That's sort of like a Gary Vaynerchuk sort of thing. But you really cannot over index on kindness. And it always pays back twofold. And so, you know, really kind of thinking about that, you know, I mentioned being born and raised in the South. I mean, some of this is, you know, my Southern roots, you know, like kind of growing up, you know.
You think the hospitality and just being neighborly and nice?
I think it's a part of it.
Yeah.
I think it's a part of it. You know, there's elements of it, right? When you go into business, people will tell you, okay, maybe not this and maybe not that. But I think there's a time and a place for everything. But finding out a way to be able to use that as a lever, right? Like, so if we're at the table and we're negotiating a contract, that's one very different side. But when that's over, can we also then go out and, you know, can we have lunch or can we have coffee? Can we talk about this thing? You know, I can congratulate you on your children's birthday. No, those are very different things. And so being able to compartmentalize like who we are in these different like spaces. And, you know, I'm sure we'll get into intersectionality at some point, too. But that's really a part of that.
I wanted to talk to you about this quote that you often is Tupac Shakur. And as I'm not saying I'm going to change the world, but I guarantee that I will spark the brain that will change the world. Now, that's something that speaks to you. So talk about the spark. How do you shift narratives?
Yes, I love this question. It's so complex and it's so many different layers. So the Tupac quote first, you know, I kind of talked about how hip hop was one of my first sort of forays into the arts, you know, and so that is just such a strong sense of who I am. So I teach at the University of North Carolina in Charlotte, City College of New York here in New York City, and also at NYU as well. And so that quote in particular really hits me as an educator first, and really thinking about, you know, how, like, the what that really means. And I use the word educator intentionally versus a teacher, right? A teacher, in my opinion, is someone who's going to show up and is somebody who's going to teach you whatever the curriculum is, or whatever the standard is, whatever it is administrators or districts or, you know, politicians are telling them that they have to teach. Those are teachers. Educators, their role in society is to elucidate or to open up the minds or to show and teach criticality to the students that are within their spaces. Those, that to me, are educators. So that quote about, you know, maybe I might not change the world, but, you know, I can spark the brain or the mind that will, is really a call to other educators that, you know, this is why we're here. This is our give back. You know, this is our pay it forward. You know, part of the reason why I got my doctorate is because I knew how important it was to see a Black man with locks calling himself doctor. And most importantly, other people having to call him doctor.
Absolutely.
You know, yes. You know, so yes. I knew how important that was. So and part of the narrative change is once you're in these spaces that has, you know, historically kept people of color out of them, you know, in the way in that they have been built intentionally, is being there and then creating content while you're there. So whether it's,
I'm loving that, being there,
being
like
there,
you and me, we're being there, we're here, right?
That's it.
We're the change. No, but seriously,
we really are. You know, be the change.
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM, and we're talking with Dr. Darrell Cooper about shifting narratives and being the change that we want to see. Let's talk about your work in the diversity, equity, inclusion, and access space. And then also, if you can speak about critical race theory and how you embed that in your work. And then there's one more, there's a part B to this. And why is being so heavily resisted in states like the one you grew up in?
Oh, I guess to talk a little bit about like the diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility work. One of the things that I saw when I first sort of started working within like the arts and culture space was that, you know, there was a huge disparity and a gap with access to arts and culture being evenly distributed. Even in a city like here in New York, it still remains incredibly segregated when you start talking about access to arts and culture. The University of Pennsylvania put out a report back in 2017 called the Social Impact of the Arts Report. So for those who saw Dr. Darrell Cooper and was hoping to get some like facts and some research, I'm gonna give you a little bit of that now.
We were looking forward to it. Right.
So the University of Pennsylvania put out the Social Impact of the Arts Report back in 2017, or the SIAP report, and they were tracking all five boroughs of New York City and access to arts and culture. And what this report, you know, I'll condense it all down to like a 15 second soundbite. So what this report uncovered was that if you overlaid a map of gaps and disparities with health, education, housing, if you overlaid that on the five boroughs of New York City, it would match up exactly with lack of access to arts and culture.
Wow.
Around the city.
Yes.
It's a complete overlap. So what does that tell us? First of all, it tells us that access to arts and culture actually increase the overall health and well-being of individuals living within those communities. So what I would posit from that is that, you know, having barriers that are put up systemically to keep us from access to arts and culture is an intentional way of providing lives that are, you know, more unhealthy, lives that are lacking in well-being. Now, that's not to say that there's not already arts and culture that is vibrant in these communities that's just not being, say, honored, right, or respected or valued in mainstream, because it is, you know, these communities, they're already living full and vibrant lives. They're not asking for anything else. I think the work that I do, particularly as a DEIA, you know, cultural strategist, you know, the point is, if a person wants this access, they should have it, right? And it should also be democratized. It shouldn't be collected and shouldn't be hoarded by those with power and privilege. That's where the problem lies in, not what's necessarily not in the communities, because the communities themselves are full and rich. The problem is in those with power intentionally trying to keep these things out in the way in which the system is structured. So that is the thing that I try to interrogate. And then the piece around the critical race theory, and I'll try to wrap this question in with why is it being banned? You know, education in general was not really built to have students that are thinking critically about the world. It's not about criticality. If you look at the rise in what we know now as like traditional sort of K through 12 education, at the rise of K through 12 education in the United States paralleled that of the rise of the Industrial Revolution. So again, just a little bit like historical like background to this. So, you know, it was never really meant for us to think critically about the world. It was meant to build the next workforce that went out to go do X, Y, and Z. And then, of course, the, you know, one of the biggest, games in history came along with the student loans, right, and the colleges and universities. And so then the goal, it had become, now we're going to take you from K to 12 to higher education to keep you then in debt for the next 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 years. So, you know, that's how those two things play together. And this, so this part around what we're seeing now with this huge pushback on critical race theory or removing AP African-American history from the curriculums, honestly, it is more of the same. Like what is old is now new. This has always been the way to, one, devalue the experiences of others in this country. But then also, the education system, again, is not built to teach us criticality. And in fact, there was a time when if you were Black in this country, you could not even go to a formal school, right? That's just a part of it. And then when you could, there was segregation. So what you're seeing now is like the, again, the systemic and intentional targeting of, you know, lives within like, you know, a curriculum sort of like standpoint. It's the same old, same old. I think what's really important to also think about, though, is while that might be the case, it makes it even more important because now we're talking about strategies. It makes it even more important if we think about it from like an abolitionist sort of education standpoint. For those educators, and again, this is the difference between educators and teachers.
Preach.
For those educators that are out there in the world, this is when you are most needed. When the Titanic was going down, the musicians played on. So if we start to see this thing sinking, this is when you lean in even more into your brilliance, even more into your Excellent. Liberatory practices, even more Excellent. Into loving and caring for these young people that are coming to your classroom in a radical way, because we know the system will not do it for them.
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FN. And today we're talking with Reverend Dr. Darrell Cooper.
You know, I'm listening to this conversation and I'm listening to how transparent you are around the intentionality of a lot that is going on in our educational system. You know, I always get caught here. I'm like, are we just saying too much? But we're not, because if we don't speak it, who's going to speak it? I think you said to me that Black people need to be in a position where they speak up more. Can you relate to, can you understand what I'm saying?
Yes. I mean, you have to speak truth to power.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to do it and you have to agitate the system. You have to.
It was Frederick Douglass who said agitate.
Agitate.
Right.
You have to agitate the system and you have to disrupt it. You know, I talked earlier about being an entrepreneur, and I think, you know, the biggest lesson that I've learned while being an entrepreneur is how important disruption actually is to the system. You know, when I first started because you also asked about narrative change.
Yes.
And I try to connect these two things together. So, you know, when I first started my consultancy, it was like, okay, you got the website, you got like the social media, you got all these things, but it's like, and this was something that my mentor, and I'll give her a shout out, Donna Walker Kuhn, She told me
she's been on Art Moves.
I know. I listened to that episode. You know, one thing she told me, she was like, you know, a person can start a business, or, you know, you can have like, you know, these different things. But the question you have to ask yourself is, who cares?
That's yes.
That's like, who cares about your product? Right. And whether that product is you, or whether it's, you know, I don't know, a soft drink, or like food, if you're a chef, like whatever it is, it's like, who cares? And so I think in doing that, part of like this narrative change piece is finding ways to be able to tell your story.
As a cultural strategist, how do you keep yourself committed and navigate through these, you know, different, wilds, if you will?
I try to read. I try to, you know, watch documentaries, listen to music. You know, most importantly, though, you know, I try to put myself or have people around me who inspire and motivate me as well. I think in doing social justice work or JEDI work, justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion, and doing this work, a lot of it, this abolition work, this liberation work, a lot of it can feel very isolating. And I think
Absolutely. Abolition work. That's really quite interesting that you're labeling it that, but that's basically, yes, what it is. Yes. Mm-hmm.
It can feel very isolating. And I think, you know, it's really important to understand, well, like two sort of points. One, the work in a lot of ways does happen individually, but then it also happens collectively as well. Right. So it's like that old African proverb, if you want to go fast, go alone. But if you want to go far, go together. So I think, you know, part of it, you know, to answer your question, Eli, I have to continually sort of reprogram and reframe my mind into not thinking that it's a me and realizing that it's a we. But we are here in this moment, but it's really about all the other moments that came before this and then all the other moments that are going to happen after this as well. That's what I kind of talked about, like over-indexing on kindness and like thinking about like those things too, because, you know, the hate that we send out into the world or the trauma that we send out into the world, that energy has vibrations.
Absolutely.
Right. But it so does kindness. So
and so it's a high love. Vibration. It's called a higher vibration. And when you're negative, you're sending out lower vibrations. I'm right with you there.
So in some ways you could actually say, if I could jump in here, that, it's a personal commitment that's sourced and also energized by community and team.
Absolutely.
Would that be accurate?
Absolutely.
I think that's where the energy comes from.
Right. But you also said something about your spirituality and knowing that this was an agreement that you made before you got here. So you said something that
you got here as a human being or got here physically?
As he incarnated into this shell that we now call our bodies.
Well, that's the purpose piece, right?
Yes.
And it kind of connects back to what I was saying earlier.
I've talked to Eli about that. We debated, but I'm not really debating it because I know.
She's trying to redeem me.
Yeah, I'm helping. I'm trying.
It's going okay.
I'm really looking forward to co-hosting.
Yes. Oh, we're holding back. Okay,
yeah, we're very dangerous together.
I love it. But yeah, I think it is a callback to the idea of purpose. I mentioned earlier that we don't necessarily get to choose our careers. We don't necessarily get to, you know, choose who we are. In those senses, those things sort of like choose us. And I really do believe that, you know. We've all found our way to where we are, especially if you're sort of like a passion driven life. You know, those things have had to find you at some point. And it really is just a matter of recognizing when you found it, how it made you feel, how it made you come alive.
But it's about knowing how you feel, being still enough to either let your body tell you or let your mind tell you or let your heart tell you, meaning there's work that you have to do to know sometimes.
It's also about being present.
Exactly.
And most people are not present.
We're thinking future, but we're thinking what happened. But we're not in that moment.
No, I understand. You only are in the moment. You only exist in the moment.
Exactly.
But most people don't think in the range of their lives like that.
Absolutely.
You know, by the way, just, you know, I had this thought too about that in a lot of ways, children choose us as parents.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, my son told me.
Absolutely.
My son already told me that.
No, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yes.
Yes.
Can I just tell you what he said?
He was thinking, my daughter was thinking about an Irish family, but just decided to go for Jewish.
No, well, my son was like, Mom, I saw you. He's, I might not have been the best kid, but I was the fastest. So I jumped in.
That's it.
You know,
he said he did.
I might not have been the best, but I was the fastest.
Well, that's it. Know. Well, you know, there's a great quote that kind of fits along with this conversation, but it's, you know, you have to know who you are. Important, but almost equally as important, you need to know whose you are.
Whose are we? You know, as we're talking here, we're talking actually about the art of living, right? We've moved this into being, but there's one question I wanted to ask because you are a hip hop scholar, and this is something that has always rested with me, and it has to do with Biggie Smalls, and he's iconic, right? And he is iconic toward Brooklyn. Why? I'm just asking the whys. Not that I don't know. I just want to hear your why. Well, no, I don't always know.
She stays up night thinking about this.
No, because when I moved to New York, right when Biggie had died, and I remember on Washington Avenue, there was all this action, and I was not in it. So what is your feeling? Because you're a hip-hop scholar, and that's why I'm asking.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was all a dream. Used to read Word Up magazine, Salt and Pepper, Heavy D up on the lip. Okay. So it's like, I think part of it is, you know, we relate to people that we can recognize and see ourselves in. And, you know, there's, you know, thinking about like Biggie Smalls, one, he was an incredible lyricist. And it was a time in the culture when lyrics and, you know, wordsmiths still mattered. So I think that was a part of it. You know, you could kind of see yourself in him, right? You know, he was very relatable in a lot of ways. I mean, he didn't have these like movie star looks. He didn't have like washboard abs. You know, he was literally, you know, especially when you think he was Brooklyn's own for that. But, you know, he was literally the guy around the block who was incredibly talented and was able to take that to the highest levels possible. So I think there's a lot about his journey that people can kind of watch and go, oh, if he did it, I could do it too. And then he was very real, you know? He was very real. He was like, you know, people called the cops on me when I was just trying to make some money to feed my daughter. Like, I mean, it's relatable. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, whether it's music, whether it's, you know, podcasting, whether it's film, you know, what people are really looking for are, again, going back to like the universality of who we are, you know, people are looking for something that they can connect to and people that they can connect to. And Eli, you kind of mentioned like how closely related we are to chickens. You know, genetically, what we're even closer related to more than anything else on this planet Earth? Fungi.
Fungi. Oh, yeah, that's a surprise.
But fungi.
Is that like a campaign to be nice to fungi?
Yeah. Or? I mean, this
is we're all connected. It's a campaign that we're all connected.
Yeah,
and
sure.
The more we realize how hyper-connected we are, I think it makes life just a little bit easier, right? Like, because sometimes we think about why do we have these problems or why these problems? Well, it's like, who else would you give them to?
Exactly. And we're all, well, spirit. Spirit has a lot to do with all of this, but that's for another episode of Art Moves,
yeah,
right?
But I think also, you know, it'd be great to have him come back.
Oh, no, well, he's going to be coming back as.
No, but hip hop.
Yeah, well, he's going to be coming back because he's coming back, okay? He's coming.
No, but I love his unique perspective.
No, I think I actually find it very kindred myself. My brother, I find us very much in alignment. Anyway, this was fantastic. Thank you so much, Dr. Darrell Cooper.
Thank you.
Art Moves is co-produced by Brick Arts Media and pre-recorded at Brick Studio in downtown Brooklyn.
This has been Art Moves with your hosts, Tony Williams and Eli Kozlansky. Find some art that moves you and share it with someone.